speciality is acousmatic compositional music concrete. So I actually prefer to call it really. And so this kind of discussion has come from there, this, which might kind of explain some of the things I'll be talking about. My own interest is really the use of well-known sounds that we kind of know what they are in acousmatic music and music concrete. And this paper is called Personal Listening and the Collective Experience System. So, it is hard to imagine a world without recording sound. The gathering up and retaining of sounds hitherto fugitive and the reproduction at will, as Edison talked about in 1878, are now well-known processes which no longer possess their initial novelty. The acousmatic listening condition, that is, the situation of listening to sound without visual reference to the sound caused, is also similarly commonplace. Just as contemporary audiences are unlikely to recoil in terror when facing the Lumiere brothers' film L'arrivée d'un train à la Ciotat, 1895, the disembodied voice of the sound recording is no longer an attraction or spectacle in itself. In Edison's day, phonographs and gramophones were often made to be quite imposing pieces of furniture built to take their place within the home and take on the role of domestic music maker, once the province of live music making by amateurs. However, recorded sound is no longer confined to the parlour or the cinema. We may easily carry with us more or less wherever we want to go many hours of recorded material, blocking out the real soundscape which constantly surrounds us with one of our own choice. The sounds we listen to and the oral spaces we inhabit, like the clothes we wear, have become very much part of a lifestyle choice. The development of the loudspeaker in particular was important in allowing recorded sound to flow out into the social domain. Sound projected into a room fills its space, and unless a great deal of trouble is taken to contain it, spills out through the many gaps and cracks it inevitably discovers, and transmits itself easily through building structures. Furthermore, sound interacts with the acoustic of the room it is diffusing through, becoming altered by it, sometimes in profound ways. As Brandon LaBelle has stated, sound thus performs with and through space. It navigates geographically, reverberates acoustically, and structures socially, where sound amplifies and silences, contorts and distorts, and pushes against architecture. It is boundless on the one hand, and site-specific on the other. Even when music is reproduced at a high dynamic level through loudspeakers, for example, it is not possible to mask entirely the listener's surroundings. Mobile listening devices, on the other hand, are often designed specifically to block out external sound and therefore sound space. Sound here is directed towards the individual for private consumption, offering an internalized listening experience more or less unmediated by the acoustic characteristics of the listener currently inhabits. When a listener promenades conjoined to a mobile listening device, sound is injected directly into his or her ear, and the natural link between visual and oral spaces is broken. As Michael Boole observes, iPod use provides users with their own unique regulated soundscape that mediates the experience of whatever space is passed through and regulates the flow of time as they wish. The meaning of these spaces, often received as non-spaces by users, is overlain by the mediated space of their very own sonic envelope from which meaning emanates. iPod users choose the manner in which they attend to these spaces, transforming space and time into their own personalized narrative. However, the recorded spaces in which the iPod listener is immersed disconnect him or her from the physical space they are currently occupying. And furthermore, there is, in fact, no need for such spaces to have any connection with the real spaces that he or she, or indeed anyone else, has experienced directly at any time. It is often assumed that the quality of a sound recording may be judged in terms of its ability to recreate the pro-phonographic event at a future time and place. This was certainly the case in the early days of sound recording, where a great deal of research was carried out into creating the perfect sound recording. Indeed, as Emily Thompson has noted, by 1913, the Edison Company consistently referred to its records, not as reproductions, but as recreations, emphasizing the authenticity of the sound that was assumed a recording could produce. Traditionally, the recording medium and its associated recording and playback technologies have been assessed in terms of their fidelity. The level of transparency between the probe phonographic event and the sound which is heard at the point of its future reception. The greater this transparency, in other words, the lower the coupling between the sound and its recording reproduction technologies, the more faithful the reproduction is sometimes considered to be to its original. However, given the de facto historical nature of all records, and thus the absence of the original probe phonographic event, the gold standard against which a recording is judged, the real sonic event, can only be something which is recollected or imagined by the listener. The memory of the listener's experience of a live concert, for example. The veracity of the recorded event is evaluated on the perceived naturalness and plausibility of what is heard, based on the listener's previous sensual understanding of the world. Therefore, sound recordings can only represent the probe phonographic event, although this may not always be a recording's intention. Any sense of realism, naturalness, or authenticity a recording appears to convey will have been constructed through the use of often well-worn codes dependent on historically mediated cultural norms. Recordings have representational intent. This is important for a sound recordist to be aware of listener expectations and the recording conventions for a particular style of content, as he or she is of the quality of the equipment being used. As Francis Rumsey has pointed out, although sound recording and reproduction started out as a means of reproducing the voices or sounds of the things people knew and could therefore recognise, it has moved well beyond to a realm of essentially artificial representation of content. Indeed, the quality of recording and reproduction equipment is in many ways far less important than the listener's expectation of how the content of the recording should sound given its cultural context. How an impression of sound space is captured on recording, using conventional techniques at least, is particularly illustrated of the representational rather than reproductive nature of recorded sound. It is impossible, for example, for the still most common format for depicting spatial sound compound, two-channel stereo, to recreate the complete sound field which was originally present at the microphone position. Rather than envelop the listener in something at least approaching the paraphonic rendition of the original sound event, stereo reproduction produces a frontal sound stage, creating at best a 60-degree window onto the original holistic experience. Given the impossibility of a literal recreation of the original sound space, the space the listener hears on reproduction at the point of reception is constructed, both through the act of sampling the original sound space and through the mediation of the sound recorders and the recording and reproduction technologies. How a space is represented on the recording is affected by such things as microphone placement, microphone type, number of microphones used, mixed down, sound format, and so on. The decisions that are made that lead to a specific approach to a recording of a sonic event are those which reflect current or sometimes purposely historic praxis and which are themselves aligned to the style of what is being recorded and how this translates to the style of the recording. Commercial concerns, for example, target audience, among other things. Our expectations of the spatial aspects of music recordings, for example, are thus also mediated by historically specific normative practices. For recording coded for realism, that is to say, where the recording is trying to recreate the experience of listening to a live event, a listener can naturally expect to feel some sense of correlation between the understood spatial norms defined by both the music and recording praxis extant at the time of this recording, and the space experienced by him or her orally at the point of reception. For example, a reasonable quality recording of organ music can be expected to recreate some impression of the spaciousness of the organ's original location. After all, part of the enjoyment of listening to sound recordings can be their ability to transport the listener to another place sonically. although I think it's worth mentioning, too, that actually Sciencebase on recording is sometimes more obvious once it's absent rather than its presence. We're quite used to kind of switching off the Sciencebase in recordings too, I think. Once we kind of hear the spatial cue, once we hear that this is an organ inside a big cathedral or something, we kind of ignore the Sciencebase completely unless something happens to it, unless it changes or unless it disappears or something else like that. So our experience of sound is sometimes summarized, I think, very quickly. Same with other kind of audio events too. We summarize them and we can quickly ignore them. It should also be observed that ordinarily live music, for example, is not enjoyed purely acousmatically. At a minimum, live music comprises something which is audiovisual, and indeed, at least to some extent, other senses may be involved in our complete reception of a specific occasion. In order to facilitate the live event's transliteration into a sound recording, artifice is required to distill its essentially more comprehensive nature. In other words, the absence of information provided by other central streams in the live situation may require the modification of the remaining information in the stream of delivery provided by the recorded one, in order that the recording is made comprehensible. Without visual cues, our perception of the space that the recorded event took place in can become unclear, and the spatial differentiation of the recording of the sounding objects within the resulting audio scene can be difficult to perceive. This may mean, in the interests of broad legibility, the establishment of a more literal sense of Sciencebase may be rejected for the establishment of one which both promotes a sense of inclusivity, including the listener, into the space, and allows important sonic events to be separated and or brought into focus. Given the absence of original, the listener has no substantive reference with which they can compare the recording to. As Francis Rumsey suggests again, without a reference point to sound quality, listeners adapt to what is on offer and rapidly accept it as the norm, as long as the quality is tolerably good. Because listeners generally have no idea about what it was intended in the first place, they are remarkably ready to accept recordings that lack fidelity in the absolute sense, provided they suit the purpose for which they are used. The impossibility of the recreation of the pro phonographic event and the necessity for the use of production techniques which can merely apply rather than reconstitute the real is suggestive of sound recording's creative potential. This is clearly realized directly in music concrete, but also in many recordings of popular music, classical music, and so on. Although sometimes this can be less obvious if a recording is coded for authenticity, you're obviously always trying to keep that creative sign back, as it were. Sciencebase is an important component of the material which is used in the creative process of building a recording up, and is an integral part of the sound design, particularly for film sound and rock and pop music, but also other things too, of course. The spaces that these designs invent need not have any correspondence to spaces in the real world. The use of delay, artificial reverberation, EQ, and indeed even microphone placement can generate novel sound spaces unrelated to the pro phonographic space, where, think of sound synthesis and sequencing, for example, this even exists. And we need to only think about the techniques used for creating music concrete, where we often record things very, very close up, and where the actual sound space of the object we're recording isn't actually even there. This sense of space actually comes from the object itself. You get this kind of artificial sense of space, which has nothing to do with the space that we're recording in. In rock and pop, for example, there's a clear distinction between recordings of live concerts and produced albums. As has already been mentioned, sound space in the latter case, as in contemporary cinema, is very much part of the overall sound design. It is not commonly used to convey a sense of specific or even a generic performance space per se, although part of the sound material used, particularly that of a more documented nature, may allude to a real space. Instead, space becomes one of the creative elements used to produce an album's sonic signature, its sound, and as such, to some degree, its use is determined and can only be fully comprehended within the music's cultural context. Sound recording has thus moved away from the concerns of the early pioneers of sound recording, such as Thomas Edison, who we were motivated primarily by the potential that it was thought Senate Cording had to achieve fidelity, their ability to recreate the real. However, as has been demonstrated, sound recording is a creative process, and the sounds we hear at the point of reception need not correspond to previous real sonic events. There is thus the potential for recording to move between real-world and non-real-world sound spaces. Thinking of acousmatic music, for example, John Young makes the distinction between sounds of recognisable real-world origin and processed or synthetic sounds which appear dissociated from known physical context, thereby setting up a continuum between reality and abstraction. In terms of recorded sound, at least, however, it would perhaps be better to consider this continuum as comprising one between sounds which are representational and those which are not. A recording's constructed soundstage, therefore, can convey a sense of space which is analogous to our experience of the real world, or one which is less so. Sound space, however, cannot be considered a completely abstract quality, I don't think. Sound spatial information must be understood in terms of the information derived from other senses, for example, that provided by sight, but also other senses, of course. When we listen to sound acousmatically, that is to say, when we cannot perceive its source visually, a range of possible sounding events may be suggested, and our essential understanding of them, from the sparely specific to the broadly generic. How we interpret this sound is determined both culturally and by our historical expectation of how sound correlates to the physical world around us and generally our sensual knowledge of it. Our understanding of sound space is therefore augmented by the constructed and indeed artificial spaces that we hear regularly on sound recordings. It should of course be noted that sound space conveyed over loudspeakers will be influenced by the acoustic of the room in which the sounds are projected. Virtual and real acoustics may merge to some extent, or one acoustic may dominate over the other. A dry room acoustic, for example, may allow the virtual recorded acoustic to dominate, whereas a reverberant room acoustic may dominate any compression of recorded space. However, whether it is intentional or not, loudspeaker reproductions tend to integrate the space inferred by the projected sound into the real space of its delivery. As has been already noted, personal listening devices, on the other hand, commonly use headphones even where these are open. The space that the listener inhabits has little or no effect on the virtual space heard. This increases the impact and dislocation of the virtual space, focusing the listener on the constructed and artificial world of the recording. Now, I think this is a big difference between a big change in the listening habit, where listening to spaces on loudspeakers, quite often I think we can ignore the space to a certain extent, especially the way we tend to listen on loudspeaker, where we're not necessarily sitting in the middle of the loudspeakers in the kind of best place or anything. Whereas when we're listening on headphones all the time, we kind of always place center stage, and we're always kind of very aware of this other space. I don't think that always happens so much in our ordinary experience of loudspeaker listening. Obviously in the studio that's slightly different. This is not to say that headphone listening or even the reproduction of binaural recordings can produce some sort of absolute version of the recorded sound. Francis Rumsey has observed, for example, that head-related transfer functions do differ, that the lack of both head movement and sound perspective coupling and visual cues can cause limitations and distortions of phase and frequency force. The response, of course, may cause difficulty, so headphones will give you an absolute experience. Naturally, these artificial and constructed spaces may still represent generic spaces in the real world. The naming of sound effects typically available on artificial reverberation units, for example, small hall, large church, etc., is illustrative of this. Our comprehension of such spaces is mediated more by our individual understanding of the context they are presented within, and our sensory knowledge generally, for example, our audiovisual appreciation of space, and less by our correlation of the artificial space to our memory of something specific. The reverberation algorithm offered by many contemporary digital effects units can also give us a further insight into the expanded spatial domain. Algorithms such as plate reverb, tape reverb, and spring reverb, these from the Lexicon MX400, attempt to emulate early approaches to sound space simulation. The very characteristic sound of the original devices have their own cultural heritage and their sound. Although they may again initiate a vision of some sort of generic space, but also more importantly connect us to the sound's cultural context. Trevor Wishart talks of formalized acoustic spaces for those spaces which have become conventions of a mode of presentation. So that has the use of particular reverberation effects on a particular genre of music. So we just nearly at it.
Yeah.
Thus, just as the grain of black and white film or the colour characteristics of early three-strip Technicolor are suggestive of the era in which the film was produced, the use of a specific plate or spring reverb can indicate an era of style of, for example, a certain music recording. More than this, the distinctive sounds that such sound effects produce are redolent of the whole cultural backstory which conveyed by and surrounds the recording. Therefore, a characteristic spatial sound is intertwined with its historical cultural significance. The manner in which something has been recorded can reference more than merely what has been recorded. Audio significance is also affected by audiovisual conventions, which again may have little connection to our experience of the real world. The use of particular types of reverberation horror films to create a sense of tension or otherworldliness, for example, may connect such sounds to the genre and their conventionalized meanings within this context. Finally, the use of samples in many genres of contemporary music sees the connotation of the spatial signatures of the samples being transferred to music they are used within, although these spatial signatures may, of course, be masked by other sounds to some extent. Indeed, the use of plundered sound allows a great deal of creative flexibility to how sound space can be used. And it should be remembered that sound space for a particular recording does not have to be a static thing. As sound space changes dynamically, what it references will change too. And this fluid sound space can become part of our expanded understanding of sound space in general. Such dynamic techniques are particularly obvious in acousmatic music, but are quite apparent in other forms of recorded music. And we only have to think of the iPod shuffle, of course, to see how we're kind of constantly being confronted by changing sound spaces. However, the ease of accessing material on the internet without necessarily having to understand its full cultural import has led to an interesting break between material and what such material signifies. So in conclusion, the rise of personal listening has created a situation which focuses the listener on the sound of the recording to which he or she has chosen to listen to, and away from the distraction to the real soundscape. The consequences of this are perhaps twofold. On the one hand, the natural soundscape is being somewhat abandoned for the more controlled and commercialized soundscape of the recording. On the other, our sound space is being expanded by the detailed positioning of constructed and artificial sound worlds. An understanding of this expanded spatial domain and the cultural context which it embodies is important for those involved in the creative use of recorded sounds, such as acousmatic composers, as ignorance of spatial context could lead to a misunderstanding of creative intention. Thank you. Thank you very much.
And thank you. We have time for questions.
Which talk? So can you talk about us?
It's a question or a remark. I think when you were talking about this high fidelity, I was thinking of this book by Jonathan Sturman. Social and ideological construct.
Yeah.
There's ideas of authenticity and the real, they have to be. And, well, actually, the point that he was making, I don't know how that relates to your talks, is that people had to be educated in order to hear what they were hearing from the speaker as the real or as an authentic performer, live performance. So they didn't make. First, they didn't make the relation between the concert, a live concert, and what they were hearing through some speakers. So people had to be told that this is exactly what they heard in a concert.
Yeah. Well, I suppose, obviously. I mean, I think this is a quite interesting thing in itself. It's how we kind of learn to listen in general anyway. I think that comes back to Francis Rumsey's point to a certain extent, that actually, despite the fact that, you know, I think there's quite, because there was this other talk the other day about high fidelity in general. I think it's quite interesting that I can kind of see it. On the one hand, we seem to be quite obsessed with trying to make things higher quality, So you actually have something like digital cinema format, which has the capability of reproducing things like 192 kilobits or 24 bit into a room which might be like this room, with you know, unideal walls or a bad light condition, like our little cinema guys. It kind of does make sense to me to a certain extent. But on the other hand, we're also very happy to listen to MP3s through kind of computer live speakers and so on. And that's something which is happening too. So you kind of have this kind of split. And I think it really comes down to the context that things are listening to and our kind of expectations and the kind of people we are. So for the kind of hi-fi fanatics, almost like the specification almost becomes like the important thing, not necessarily the listening experience even. Whereas for other people, the culture is more of this kind of sharing of stuff, being able to share stuff in a certain kind of domain. And it might, again, the actual sound itself doesn't come apart. I often think that it's sort of less important, the sound itself is kind of very less important in many senses for a lot of people. And so this concept of high fidelity is something that we actually, I suppose, no one really talks about high fidelity anymore. Mm-hmm. So we actually don't really talk about high fidelity as much. We have started to talk about high-end audio instead rather than high fidelity. So it has changed.
Yes.
Anyone
else?
Talking about how actually the actual hearing experience becomes less important.
Mm.
You said about live music that other senses should be involved as well, or
yeah.
are important for the experience. And so I think it's especially with the MP3 listening, it is not only other senses, but there is also some kind of, let's say, I would almost call it inner hearing, which is involved.
Mm.
So you only get a very small amount of information, audible information, but you are creating, and so you get some snippets of the sound, of the song, let's say, but you are creating or recreating that song in your head because you know it. So you only need, you know, some chords or a bass line or whatever it is, and then you can. That is enough for you to experience the music.
No, that's kind of what I said as well. It within pop is that actually you quite often summarize sound quite quickly. I mean, like sound spaces. On one hand, you know, sound spaces is very important. We spend a lot of time trying to create sound spaces. I mean, thinking about classical music in particular, you know, we try and recreate this and so on. But on the other hand, you kind of notice how things like 5.1 DBA hasn't really taken off. You know, you'd expect that to be something that hi-fi fanatic listening to classical music, for example, might be very interested in recreating the kind of complete virtual, kind of creating a more enveloped kind of soundscape. But that hasn't really happened. And I think it's partly because, again, as you say, once you hear the cue. It's a bit like, I suppose it's a little bit like, you know, radio dramas. When you listen to a radio drama on the radio, this would be a British record, but when you listen to the Archers or something like that, which is kind of like just a kind of drama, regular drama, they kind of give you a sense of the space things are in, but in order to make it intelligible, they quite often just take it away again. So you just pour a play for that happen. So you get something set up and then it gets taken away. We kind of assume it's all there, you know, a bit like the establishing shot in the film. I think it's a little bit the same in sound space in recorded sound too. We kind of feel this establishing of something, but then we kind of ignore it. We're kind of not involved with it to a certain extent, I think. And I think that maybe, and I might be wrong here, but I kind of feel the difference perhaps between listening to something which is actually straight in your ears, but it's harder to kind of perhaps to completely get away from that because you're actually confronted by this space that's in your ears and the space that's around you, which is actually that's changed. I really suppose my point is that this is kind of expanding our experience of sound space in general. That, you know, what we refer to when we refer to this kind of our understanding of sound space, it also includes all this kind of sound space that we experience through recorded sound. And I think that's probably happening more because of personal listening devices than, say, the loudspeakers, which tend to integrate into the space that they're in a little bit more, to a certain extent, obviously, not completely.
Yeah, time's up. I had one question before we went on halfway, but it's this notion of
it's a little bit time.
This notion of collective experience,
yes,
in your title that you didn't talk that much about.
Yes,
and I was wondering.
It's one of those things
because this, it sounds so obvious, collective experience, but when you think a little about it, what is it actually? Because is it still individual experience in a common setup or with other people, or is it something totally different that you would call collective experience?
Well, I suppose
because how, who is experiencing collectively without being an individual listener? Because in your title, they're somehow.
Yeah, no, it's one of those titles that probably should have changed when you died here. But I think that's obviously something that which has changed a little bit. I mean, you can imagine that even in the early days of the gramophone and the radio, in fact, and the television, in fact, you know, I suppose television is still quite collective. But, you know, people really, it really took the place of some kind of collective music making, and people still experienced it together to a certain extent. It was something, because it was novel, it was something that people would listen together to. But I suppose, like many other things, our collective experience is coming through this kind of commercialized or fragmented kind of world, in that, you know, we are all listening to, well, we're not all listening to the same music, but many of us are listening to the same music, so people who are listening to the same types of things are kind of experiencing the same kinds of things, sound spaces, even though they're listening to it in an individual way, we're still kind of having this kind of collective experience.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose what I was trying to drive at is our kind of collective understanding of sound space is being changed through these individual experiences.
So it's actually one sort of culture experience.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Time is up and